Thanks, Marty. First of all, I find this conversation very, very positive. I think the success of our system requires coordinated efforts between the financial reporting standard setters, the auditors, and the auditing regulators and the securities regulators. And thinking holistically about how we make the system work together best is a very important thing that we should have been doing all along. And perhaps we've done it in fits and spurts, but if we could continue that, that I think is probably a very, very significant positive move forward. In terms of documentation, I agree with Sam. I don't see that the FASB has a role in prescribing preparer documentation. First of all, that preparer documentation isn't going to be used by us. It's going to be used by auditors and regulators. And I think that we would be woefully poor at thinking through how to do that well. But I also agree maybe it's not a role of the auditing standard setter, but I thought I was most encouraged to think about what Brian said, that there are securities laws that suggest that there are books and records that must be in place and that there's internal control documentation that must be in place for related to accounting. And that's an area I think we need to explore whether or not we could connect the dots better about what books and records and internal control documentation is necessary to be able to support financial reporting systems within our economy, because that may be the place where it rightfully resides. And then the ultimate regulator can end up making the judgments as to whether that's good or not in some of their enforcement activities and in coordination with the PCAOB. But that's not really for me to make a call about. A third observation. Sometimes we fall into the conversation as if uniformity is comparability. That is, if you account for a transaction identically everywhere, that leads to comparability. And I don't know that that's necessarily the case. All transactions are not the same, and they do not have all the same economic roles within business models of companies. And so sometimes I think we have to be thinking about that there ought to be the ability to have judgments to create differences in how we measure or recognize certain things, even though they might be very similar transactions. And lastly, I want to react to Sam's sort of observation about fair value being necessarily less reliable. In some instances, I think that really is a challenge. But of course, if there's a fair value that you have an observable level one market price, there's no reliability issue there. And I think we have to think very carefully, back to the slide that's up here now, what our challenges are about fair values. Because in most fair value valuation models, you have to come up with cash flows, probability-weighted cash flows or cash flows. But we're seeing that required in an allocated historical cost model if we think about leases or revenue now. You've got to come up with discount rates in a fair value model, but that's going to be in an allocated historical cost model too. So what is the difference? I think the difference is our lack of familiarity or comfort with the model that you put the cash flows and the discount rates into, and whether or not we're selecting the best model. And where I think auditing guidance, where I look at the auditing standards or talking about auditing fair value, it doesn't precisely look at making judgments or evaluations as to whether the model that's being, the cash flows are being put into or the discounts are being put into, is the best model for capturing the economics of that transaction. So I would suggest at least thinking about whether specifically moving away from estimates and judgments that tend to look at inputs to models as to whether there ought to be something to think about judgments about models too.
Thanks, Tom. Next, Bill Gradison.
I just want to pick up on a point that Sam made. I've been trying over the years that I've been here to understand why we haven't been able to find more of a common ground with the other two standards writers in our auditing standards. It's a great disappointment to me that we have not. But in trying to understand why, if I'm right that that is the case, trying to understand why that is the case, I think it's that we're writing auditing standards that we can inspect against. Which is a point that Sam, you didn't use those words, but I think that's kind of what he was saying. That's what came through to me. Now, nothing necessarily wrong with that, but if that's true, then I think it would be useful as part of this discussion, maybe now or another time, to really explore whether some of the basic assumptions that we've used in writing all of our auditing standards need to be reexamined in light of the change of direction of many of the key accounting standards and the greater range of judgment that's going to be involved. Because it seems to me that with the obvious and very important exception of making sure that there's adequate documentation of how the judgments were reached, that the inspectors aren't going to have a hell of a lot to do in applying our standards that we have today to this new world that is over which we have no control, which is moving ahead rather smartly, quickly.
Thank you, Bill. And we've next, Ian Dingwall, Kevin, you've been waiting patiently, so you're next.
I'm a patient guy. I've been listening to this discussion, you know, I guess I need to talk about my world a little bit. I think most of you deal with what I'll call the above-average auditor. I don't see always the above-average auditor. I see auditors that usually need a lot of guidance. And frankly, when I got my job many years ago now, it occurred to me that we really inherited an idea, and that was to put out for people who are auditing employee benefit plans an accounting and audit guide that basically brought together for people who are auditing plans both the accounting information and the auditing techniques that could be employed. And the guys that are out, I hope, auditing benefit plans today take the audit guide for auditing employee benefit plans as kind of their Bible. It's what they use day in and day out. Now, it's not their audit program. They develop their audit programs, you know, more specifically and tailored for re-engagement, we hope, although that doesn't always happen. But it does seem to me represent a great opportunity that the board has to put out more specific guidance that kind of brings us all together. Industry audit guides, I would hope that the board would give that some considerations. You know, there's no reason for every firm here to put together kind of a guide on how to audit broker-dealers. You know, perhaps the PCAOB could do this, and you would encourage uniformity among the firms in terms of what they do and what they consider as part of their work. So that's my pitch for industry audit guides.
Thank you. Next, Barbara Roper.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about this issue of judgment framework and why investor advocates tend to get a little nervous when we hear that conversation. And it has nothing to do with the benefits of a judgment framework per se. I mean, clearly there is a benefit to having a sensible, well-thought-out framework in which judgments are made. When we get nervous is when we hear what seems to be the inevitable second part of that process, which is, and you should respect those judgments. And the notion is, I mean, so the way it plays out then is you have the issuer, the future Enron or whatever, who says, this is my professional judgment. I followed an appropriate framework in reaching it, and you, the auditor, should respect that. And the future Arthur Andersen finds a way to get comfortable with that professional judgment and doesn't second-guess it because, after all, they also believe in not second-guessing professional judgments based on a framework. And they turn to the PCAOB, and they say, this is my professional judgment, and I followed an appropriate framework in arriving at it. And you should respect that. And we heard it today. You know, the inspectors should respect those judgments. And I'm sorry, but I think the whole notion of skepticism is that you're supposed to question those judgments. You're not supposed to respect those judgments, and the regulators are supposed to question those judgments. That's why the PCAOB was created. And this seems to me to be headed down when we, not the notion of a framework per se, but the notion of a framework that we then take as either an implied or an explicit safe harbor is exactly the opposite direction of what Congress intended when it passed Sarbanes-Oxley and created this body.
Thanks, Barbara. Next, Mike Gallagher.
I just wanted to say a quick word about the staffing model. Marty, when you asked the question about the staffing model, it was really about relative mix, right? Partner, manager, and below. And why I believe that there won't be a massive change in the mix, I said that there might be some, and clearly significant judgments need to be made by the more senior members of the team. But for every judgment that's made, there's generally assumptions underlying the judgment, and there's facts underlying those assumptions, which will need to be audited, generally by the less experienced staff, and that's appropriate. So I think that the total hours may in fact go up. In fact, they probably will. If you think about how easy it is to look at an answer and find an answer in a book versus everything that goes into a judgment, the judgment generally takes longer. It's going to put pressure not only on auditors, but preparers. So just to clarify the remarks.
Thanks for that clarification. That's very helpful. Thank you. Jim Cox?
Yeah, I want to go back to this point. I think we're actually talking past each other. So the observation was made earlier that accounting standards should have within them auditable criteria. And I thought I heard Sam and Tom reject that notion. And I hope that that's just a misunderstanding. As you move from what may be generally referred to as rules-based to principles-based accounting, and you get into a range of much more estimates and assumptions and judgments, et cetera, that there needs to be something in the formulation of the accounting principles themselves, Tom, it seems to me, as to what is the fair areas for implementing these policies or these practices. And, I mean, it's not just going out and talking to three cab drivers, we all agree to that, about what the value is of your portfolio, okay? But there ought to be something, that you could identify as to what would be reliable databases for, et cetera, for determining whether assets have been impaired or not. And that should be something that's part of the standard. And then that gets back to the question we've seen earlier about the necessity of the auditor sitting down and having this conversation with the CFO or other senior executives about exactly why there's a disagreement here and why the estimate is that they're being overly aggressive here and actually enter into impermissible bounds. So I think that there is something that the FASB has to be doing, and these things don't just get divided into little parts. Otherwise, as was wisely pointed out today, without that criteria in the standards themselves, then it's going to be very hard to audit around them.
Thanks for those comments. In the interest of time, if we could wrap up with the last comment on this first two topics with Doug Carmichael.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on the theme of the need for coordination. We don't have an internal control standard setter, and we probably don't need another standard setter. And that means that the existing bodies, the FASB and the PCAOB and the SEC and the AICPA, need to coordinate on whose standards will contain those requirements. I think it would be a huge mistake to get into a turf concern that would leave a void in the area. If we recognize the need for standards for documentation as things move ahead into more principles-based accounting judgments, then we should have a coordination. And I would hope that the FASB wouldn't categorically reject the need to include some documentation standards. I think a good model for the kind of thing needs to be done is probably SEC Staff Accounting Bulletin 102 on the relationship between the loan loss allowance and the need for documentation of the support of that number and documentation supporting the methodology to determine the loan loss allowance. That kind of guidance is needed. It's not needed just in the loan loss allowance area, but I picked that because I think it's a good example. It's a very difficult accounting measurement, and it points out the need for that additional guidance on what kind of documentation you do need. And I think it would be feasible for the SEC, and if nobody else does it, the SEC is going to have to do it for public companies on filling this void in the need for guidance on documentation. However, I know we're concerned with public companies here, but there are a lot of private companies out there, and there are a lot of auditors that audit private companies, and they're going to be having to adhere to these same accounting standards with the same kind of problems. So if it's just the SEC that provides that guidance, that again will leave a void. So I believe that there's a need for a greater coordination. Generally, the auditing standards need to pick up and maybe pick up on the problems and get into other standard setters' turfs because mostly the auditing standards come last. The accounting standards get set first, and the SEC guidance comes out first, and the auditing standards, in my estimation, then need to pick it up. But if that creates problems, then the answer is not to leave a void there so we preserve everybody's turf, but to coordinate in advance to make sure that the guidance, the standards, are there when they're needed and not patched up later.
Doug, I think your analogy was very good in terms of the importance of prepared documentation, and in one particular area that's very challenging, the loan loss allowance, and what's reasonable in that area is a very wide range of acceptability, and therefore if we're prepared to document very specifically how they got to that allowance, I think that guidance is very helpful in that area. And I think it's very important, SAB 102. So I think your analogy, and then I think back to Wayne's comments before about the many judgments that have to be made in revenue recognition, and therefore the importance of similar type of guidance with respect to what kind of documentation would be expected around those judgments should be very helpful to the reliability of the financial preparation as well as to the ability to audit that. So good analogy, and I think it's a very good point. We started, Charlie, with you introducing this topic, and so why don't we end, Charlie, with you closing it out.
Thanks, Marty. Arch, I think, rightfully pointed out the issue of risk tolerance. I think it's something that's kind of maybe lost in our discussion today, but over half our population is invested in the market. Many of those people fall in the baby boomer category. At the same time that we're asking for investors and regulators to be more tolerant, the truth is many of the investors are actually having less tolerance for risk. And I think we're going to be basically doing something that's close to jumping out of an airplane. It's fine to jump out of an airplane when you have a parachute. It's another thing to jump out of the airplane and then try to build the parachute. So I think it's just incumbent upon all of us to really think through these issues and make sure that we actually have a good plan in place before we implement some of these standards.
Thanks, Charlie, and thanks, Tony and Barbara. I think at this point in time we have gotten great input with respect to this topic. I think we've learned a lot from everybody's views. We're a little bit behind schedule. I think we're scheduled for a break at 10:30. So why don't we do that at now, and let's try to be back at 11 o'clock. Thank you.
Hello?
We'll be continuing momentarily.
Okay.
I want to thank everybody for your participation in that last discussion. To us, it's a very, very important discussion, and Tom Linsmeyer and I had a chance to chat during the coffee break, and whether you consider removing from a rules-based to a principles-based, I don't think is the major point. We're changing the framework to a very large degree, and I think dialogue of this type, which includes the FASB and the PCAOB, hearing the views together of people around this table is beneficial to both parties and very important for us to continue the dialogue, the PCAOB and FASB and SEC together as the framework changes. So it was a very important topic, and I appreciate the tremendous amount of input on the topic. On the next topic, we're discussing rulemaking on failure to supervise. And Bella Rivshin, our Associate Chief Auditor, and Michael Stevenson, Deputy General Counsel, will lead that discussion. But to kick off the discussion, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Steve Harris to begin. Thanks, Steve.
Well, thank you, Marty. And I want to preemptively thank everybody for their very active discussion on this topic to come as well. So we're looking forward to your active engagement on it. This is not a new topic. Members of the SAG first discussed the auditor's responsibility to supervise on February 27, 2008, and a number of you I know were present at that meeting. During today's discussion, we are seeking your view specifically on the board's August 5, 2010 release relating to the application of the failure to supervise provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. The release addresses two critically important objectives. The first is to remind auditors that the board has the authority and will use it to take disciplinary action against a registered public accounting firm or its supervisory personnel where appropriate for a failure to supervise. The second objective is to solicit comment on specific concepts for developing a rulemaking proposal that could lead to a firm's documenting the supervision responsibilities related to each audit from the first line supervisor for each part of an audit, all the way to the responsibilities of the managing partner of the firm. This objective in particular is what we would like to discuss today. Since coming to the board in June 2008, I have been struck by the volume, and this is meant to be a deliberately broad statement, of supervisory concerns brought to our attention by our inspection division. For example, in the board's December 2008 report on large firm inspections, the board identified inadequate supervision and review as an important factor that allowed audit deficiencies to occur. In addition to questions about the supervision and review activities of engagement managers and partners, the board identified supervision-related concerns in several other areas, including partner evaluation and compensation processes, concurring review policies and procedures, internal inspection programs, and the evaluation, supervision, and control of work performed by foreign affiliates. As the release states, the board is therefore considering proposing rules requiring firms to make and document clear assignments of relevant supervision responsibilities throughout the firm. The board is considering whether such rules would serve to further the public interest and protect investors by increasing clarity about who within the firm is accountable for various supervisory responsibilities that bear on the quality of the firm's audits. The comment period on the board's release will remain open until November 3rd, and we encourage you to submit written comments on the potential rulemaking concepts. We are especially interested in hearing how investors, audit committee members, and others who rely upon audited financial statements view the importance of clearly defined and documented supervisory responsibility at accounting firms. At this time, I will turn the floor over to Michael Stevenson and Bella Rivshin, who will provide additional information regarding the board's application of the failure to supervise provision and moderate today's discussion on the potential rulemaking concepts.
Thank you, Steve. As Steve noted, Steve described the two prongs of the August 5th release. I'm going to provide brief background on the first point, the first piece of it, relating to the scope or potential application of Section 105C6 of the Act, as described by the board in the release. And Bella will discuss the second point, the rulemaking concept portion of the release, with respect to which the board is seeking public comment and seeking your input today. Under Section 105C6 of the Act, if an associated person of a registered public accounting firm violates any provision of law, rules, or standards referenced there in the Act, the board may, in addition to imposing sanctions on the person who commits the violation, impose sanctions on other individuals or the firm if the board finds that there was a failure reasonably to supervise that associated person. Specifically, Section 105C6 provides that the board may impose sanctions on a registered firm or a, quote, supervisory person, close quote, of the firm if an associated person of the firm commits certain violations, which I'll refer to as predicate violations, and the firm has failed reasonably to supervise that person either as required by the rules of the board relating to auditing or quality control standards or otherwise, with a view to preventing such violations. You can see that there are two distinct bases there: failure reasonably to supervise as required by rules or standards, what I'll refer to as the rules clause of the section, and a failure otherwise to reasonably supervise, what I'll call the or otherwise clause. In isolation, the rules clause of Section 105C6 would be essentially redundant of authority provided to the board elsewhere in the Act. That is, to the extent the board adopts rules or standards related to supervision, the sanctioning authority provided through the rules clause of Section 105C6 overlaps with the board's separate broad authority to impose sanctions for violations of rules and standards as provided in a different section of the Act. On the other hand, the range of conduct that the board might address through the or otherwise clause encompasses conduct not covered by specific supervision rules or standards. For conduct in this category, the board's authority to impose sanctions is found only in Section 105C6 and would involve case-by-case determinations concerning the reasonableness of supervision in particular circumstances without regard to whether any specific supervision rules or standards are implicated. And this is probably a good point to mention that the Senate report on the Act describes Section 105C6 as intended to provide for liability on terms that are similar to those that apply to broker-dealers under the Exchange Act. Those Exchange Act provisions do not limit their application to circumstances involving violations of specific supervision rules. And in that sense, the or otherwise clause in Section 105C6 helps to fulfill the intent described in the Senate report. The release also discusses the scope of persons who might be subject to sanctions under Section 105C6. The Act provides that the board may impose sanctions on a firm or upon a supervisory person of a firm. The question arises how, if at all, that limits the universe of associated persons whom the board may sanction for failure to supervise. To the extent that board auditing standards prescribe supervision obligations for any specified category of individuals, they're essentially limited to obligations imposed on members of the audit engagement team. The reach of Section 105C6, though, is not limited in that way. Nor does anything in Section 105C6 indicate that the term supervisory person limits that section's reach to those with direct and immediate supervisory responsibility for the associated person who commits a violation. Any associated person in the firm, including even the most senior personnel of very large firms, could be a supervisory person for Section 105C6 purposes, depending upon the nature of his or her responsibility, ability, or authority in relation to the conduct of the associated person who commits a predicate violation. That said, it does not follow that each person with such responsibility, ability, or authority in relation to a particular violation could be sanctioned merely because the predicate violation occurred. The release describes the board's view that Section 105C6 sanctions would be appropriate only where in relation to the predicate violation, there has been a failure to exercise such responsibility, ability, or authority reasonably. Another significant scope question relates to identifying areas of responsibility that can be understood as involving responsibility to supervise in the sense that makes the conduct reachable through Section 105C6. Some supervision responsibilities are rooted in certain board auditing standards. For example, AU Section 311 and its board adopted successor on supervision, AS number 10, impose certain obligations on the engagement partner to supervise the work performed on a particular audit. Additional supervision responsibilities are rooted in the board's quality control standards. The introduction to those standards notes that they relate to quality control procedures to ensure that services are, quote, competently delivered and adequately supervised, close quote. QC standards broadly define a system of quality control as a process to provide the firm with reasonable assurance that its personnel comply with applicable professional standards and the firm's standards of quality. QC standards include a section on monitoring a firm's audit practice and include a section on a firm's responsibilities related to staffing audits, particularly the firm's responsibilities concerning the competencies of the practitioner in charge of an audit. Associated persons who have responsibilities related to implementation of components of those categories, whether broadly or with respect to only a portion of the firm's audit practice, have responsibilities that, depending on the facts and circumstances, could be understood as supervision responsibilities in relation to an individual associated person. Whether the connection between particular unreasonable supervisory conduct and a particular predicate violation is sufficient to warrant sanctions under Section 105C6 will depend on the specific facts and circumstances. But as a general matter, as the board described in the release, individuals' responsibilities for implementing a firm's QC policies and procedures are responsibilities that relate to supervision, and given a sufficient connection to a predicate violation, unreasonably carrying out those responsibilities could result in sanctions for failure to supervise. The release also recognizes that Section 105C6 does not create any form of strict failure to supervise liability for the firm or supervisory personnel just because an associated person commits a violation. Section 105C6 provides the possibility of an affirmative defense that could preclude the board from imposing sanctions against a supervisory person for failure to supervise. That section provides that no supervisory person can be found to have failed reasonably to supervise if the individual reasonably discharged the supervisory duties placed on him or her by the firm's procedures, and the individual had no reasonable cause to believe the firm's procedures were not being complied with, and the firm's procedures comply with applicable board rules and would reasonably be expected to prevent and detect the violation. That's a short overview of the part one of the August 5th release. And before I turn things over to Bella, I just wanted to highlight that, as explained in the release and is reiterated by Steve, the board has not in the release sought comment on the points I've been describing. Rather, the release expresses the view that debate about those points is more appropriately suited to take place in the context of the board's application of them in concrete situations. The release does, however, seek comment on conceptual approaches to rules to achieve a specific end, increasing clarity about who within a firm is accountable for various responsibilities that bear on the quality of audits. And for more on that, I'll now turn it over to Bella.
Thank you, Michael. Now I'd like to discuss the solicitation of comments on the rulemaking concepts. The PCAOB staff, through inspections and enforcement, at times has observed that the quality of supervision within a firm was affected by the lack of clarity regarding the allocation of various supervisory responsibilities at different levels within the firm's practice. The staff believe that the rules requiring the firm to make and document clear assignments of responsibility for implementing the necessary quality control policies and procedures could help avoid potential confusion within a firm about where the significant responsibility rests, the confusion that could potentially lead to gaps in supervision
with consequent violations of the professional standards. In addition, the staff believe rules could facilitate the PCOB's assessment through the inspection process of a firm's supervisory practices. The potential rules could also facilitate identifying, after a predicate violation has occurred, the persons with relevant supervision responsibilities. The types of rules the staff is considering would not create new supervision responsibilities, but would only address how clearly the firms assign responsibilities that are clearly already required to be part of the audit, any audit practice. The potential rulemaking would be in addition to the board's current quality control standards, QC 20, 30, and 40. The staff has preliminarily considered how such a rule might be crafted. The concept release outlines two potential approaches, a general and a more detailed approach. One possibility is to formulate a rule that only in the general terms requires assignment of responsibility and documentation of that assignment. Under this approach, a rule could build on the existing requirement that responsibility for the design and maintenance of the quality control policy and the procedures be assigned to appropriate individuals and could require firms to document all such specific assignments sufficient to cover the full range of the firm's obligation under the quality control standards and to assign to other associated persons any appropriate higher level supervisory responsibilities over those persons. In other words, if a firm complied with the rule, it could be possible to identify, with respect to a particular violation and an audit, any individuals who had responsibility for any aspects of the quality control system that failed, and to identify other individuals with supervisory responsibility for those individuals' performance relating to the quality control system. Another approach could involve a more detailed formulation. Under this approach, a rule could identify and define various specific areas of supervisory responsibility and could require a firm to assign responsibility in each area to specifically identified individuals. The areas of supervisory responsibility identified in a more detailed approach could be derived from the board's quality control standards. The potential benefit of a more detailed approach would not be to encompass more or different areas of supervisory responsibility than the general approach, but would just be to make more concrete the scope of the rule's requirement, so to reduce a risk posed by the general approach, that a firm might think that it has covered the relevant range of responsibilities, only to have the board identify a gap in the firm's assignments. The staff believes that the firm could have some flexibility in the aspects of how it approaches compliance and with the potential rule under either potential approach. Now, the previous discussion on the FASB and the ISB accounting standards was very lively, and I hope you saved some of that energy and thoughts for this topic, because we would really like to hear some of your thoughts. And to start off the discussion, the staff is interested in obtaining feedback on whether such potentials rules would serve to further the public interest and protect investors by increasing the clarity about who within the firm is accountable for the various responsibilities that bear on the quality of the firm's audits. Also, the staff is interested in hearing from investors, audit committees, and others who rely on the audited financial statements, view the importance of the clearly defined documented supervisory responsibilities in the accounting firms. And now I'll turn it over to start the discussion. Barbara Roper?
What the heck, since nobody's jumping in, I'll start. I'm a strong supporter of having clear suitability standards in this area. I think it benefits everybody. My guess is, not knowing everything about how this works in the audit firm context, my guess is that there are some areas where supervisory responsibility is already clearly defined and clearly understood, and other areas, particularly within broader networks of the larger organization, where there is less clarity. And so I do think there's a benefit to having a rule that requires a clear documentation, definition and documentation of the entire, you know, chain of command of responsibility, and I think it needs to track up through the entire organization. I think some of the benefits, you know, I think it focuses the mind of the individual who has that responsibility if it's absolutely clear that they're the one holding the bag at the end of the day. I think it gives the board something to inspect against in terms of whether people are adequately performing their supervisory obligations. And in worst case scenario, I think it, you know, can be the basis of enforcement actions, all of which I think have the potential to drive audit quality. I don't have a strong opinion about the benefits of a more general versus detailed approach. My guess is there's some middle ground there that, you know, maybe defines general areas that have to be covered by this, but it doesn't need necessarily to be too prescriptive. The more prescriptive it is, the less scalable it is. The more prescriptive it is, the more tendency there is to think it defines the scope of the requirement, so, you know, less ability to adjust and adapt it to different firm models. And I think the board has an effective mechanism, if it will use it, to require adjustments if it sees problems, which is, you know, the ability to require remediation based on inspections creates that interplay between the firms and the boards that can drive this, you know, if there are inadequacies in the approach, can drive it in the desired direction. You know, obviously that, to particularly in the early days, that should be not in a sort of gotcha approach, but in a, you know, look, good first effort, we think there needs to be something more robust in this area or whatnot, let's drive that conduct and then, you know, use that as the basis for strengthening the requirements.
Thank you, Barbara. Arch?
Well, from my standpoint, I don't think you can overstate the importance of supervisory responsibilities. And then when I think about the years I've been dealing with our quality control system, some of the things you've indicated in here, it strikes me it really fits best into all your efforts that are going on with the QC standards and to embed it in those standards. As Barbara indicated, I think if you try and get too prescriptive with this, it doesn't fit the wide range of firms that are going to have to be trying to implement it. You know, we certainly our people need, and so in our documented quality control, we lay out who has what responsibilities in what areas, and we're always looking at that from a standpoint of, how do we improve it? Do we need to change it as things might change? And it's engagement level, it's client acceptance, it covers all of the different areas of the quality control system. And so that's why I just thought it would fit best in that effort rather than something separate.
Just to follow up, Arch, if I understood what you were saying, it sounded like in your firm you believe you follow sort of the general approach already, but for each area of responsibility that would be described in the QC standards, there is somebody, a person, who's identified with that responsibility. Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, I wouldn't say by name because obviously people change over time, but positions, yes, in terms of client acceptance, good example. I mean, we have, depending on the nature of the client, certain factors that we take into consideration, our levels of client acceptance, who has to be involved with the approval of a new client, goes up the chain, so to speak, and so the positions are described as to how that is to take place.
Thanks.
Arch. Mary Hartman Morris.
Thank you, Bella. I just wanted to add to that, I agree with both Barbara and Arch on the requirements, and I agree it probably shouldn't be too prescriptive. I think it should be up to the audit firms, but I think that one point I wanted to make sure that was pointed out, the ACAP recommendation, and it really does tie into some of the key indicators of audit quality. So I think this is just one more step towards doing that. So the firms, you know, they would document necessarily, you know, who would be responsible for certain assignments. But it would be maybe eventually tied to some of their key performance indicators of quality and the training and individuals that are involved in the actual reviews. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Wayne Collins?
Yeah, I guess this is a less contentious than the earlier discussion. I also agree with the general nature of how the guidance should be couched and that it should be incorporated in the quality control standards. I think one thing is essential is that there needs to be some kind of a clear delineation or a clear understanding of what constitutes supervisory personnel versus management personnel. I think that would be certainly something that firms with their various structures would need to be able to know who fits within this particular part of the standard.
Wayne, could you elaborate a little bit in terms of the supervisory personnel versus the management personnel? Are we talking about kind of the management of the firm and how those individuals may never go to a supervisory level if you drill down all the way down to the engagement partner?
Yeah, I guess you're looking at what is their role in the firm and, you know, what aspect of their role might touch on the conduct of an audit and how they might affect the conduct of an audit and how indirect does it have to get before they ultimately do, because you have people whose primary responsibilities are operational in nature, but within those operations there may be evaluation of personnel, and it's sometimes hard to make a clear distinction between operations responsibilities and supervision responsibilities, and I think that has to be thought out some more before the guidance is promulgated.
Thank you. Steve Rafferty.
Thank you. I had, honestly, a little trouble understanding the issue here, because if you just say failure to supervise, that's a fairly broad category of issues. It would be helpful to me to know more specifics about what the observations were from the inspections. What were the actual findings and the problems in the audit? Were they failure to review the work or something else? And I would tend to question then whether I have a hard time believing in most cases that there's really a lack of clarity as opposed to a failure to execute. And if it's a failure for people to do their jobs, which they ought to understand to begin with, then I would tend to agree with perhaps where Arch was going, which was this is really part of the quality control system, and are there adequate hooks and tools and checks and balances in the quality control system to ensure that people do what they already know that they're required to do.
Thank you, Steve. Jim Cox?
The name John Gutfreund is famous in history for two reasons. One, he was the character in Tom Wolfe's novel, The Lion, and you're thinking about the other one is that he was CEO of Salomon Brothers during the bond squeeze by a person who later had a prime role, poster child role, in the long-term capital. The reason I bring that up is that as you draft this rule and you think about specificity versus non-specificity and going either way and what you mean by supervisors, the leading authority in securities law is the John Gutfreund decision, which was an SEC decision that sets forth its thinking about what makes one a supervisor. And it went through a whole cast of characters, which includes, by the way, the general counsel of Salomon Brothers. And the SEC goes to great lengths to say that you're not a supervisor merely because the compliance office is run out of the general counsel's office, but because of the level of involvement with the general counsel, Salomon Brothers, in the conversations about what to do about this character that was manipulating the treasury bond market, a bidding process. And so I think that should be instructive to you just going forward as to at least what one regulator thinks the meaning of supervision means and what qualifies one as a supervisor.
Thank you, Jim. Lynn Turner?
think you have to think in broad terms when you talk about supervision. The tone at the top takes you right to the very top, and we've heard people say how tone at the top is so important in companies, and it's no different for the accounting firms. And we've seen a number of cases, Xerox, Parmalat, Enron, where people right up to the very senior, most senior level in those firms were involved in critical and key decisions. So I don't believe a narrow definition of a supervisor is functional or will work. It will isolate the very people at the top who are so key to making sure that people have got the right mindset from any responsibility, and I don't think that's the direction you want to go in as well. I would also say, though, probably much more effective than any rulemaking in this area, which may be necessary, I don't set that aside, though, is a couple really good enforcement actions. If you found problems with people failing to supervise, then let's see the actions. I understand you've got this problem with these things staying private and people litigating. But let's, if you've got a problem, you think it's a serious problem, let's see some of these enforcement actions and bring actions against a couple of these people, because I think that will do more to cause people in the field to actually start doing their job and supervising, to Steve's point, than will all the regulations you can possibly write. If people know they're going to be held accountable for supervising, I think that'll be great. But we've had rules for a long time that have said, you know, you're supposed to supervise and stay on top of these people. I can't imagine not a partner that doesn't understand that today. And so if there's a breakdown down at the partner level, that person is the one ultimately accountable. And there's nothing like a good old couple of good-fashioned enforcement actions whacking those people really good to wake everyone up and improve performance.
Thank you, Lynn. Barbara Roper?
Yeah, I agree very much with what Lynn just said about the need for enforcement actions. Yesterday I mentioned the large firm report that Levitt did during the early 1990s, looking at the 9 largest broker-dealer firms. And the issue there, again, was that there had been reports that the major broker-dealer firms were hiring individual registered reps with long records of customer abuses, and that those individuals were able to stay in the firm and continue to pile up additional customer abuses within firms that were supposed to have good, strong procedures in place to prevent that sort of thing. And what Chairman Levitt did with that report was to basically say one of the responses that we're making to this is going to be to put a much greater emphasis on failure to supervise. In other words, we're going to recognize this is not just an issue of bad apples. These are firms that are tolerating this conduct, and we're going to hold people accountable up the chain for the decisions that allow that to happen, and that is going to inform the way we approach enforcement in this area. He announced it, everybody's on notice, and then, you know, you proceed with that approach. And I think that's key. I also think this is, you know, not to beat a dead horse, increasingly important as we move into an area where we're dealing with more judgments. You know, the type of issues we've talked about, you know, related to the need to get more documentation, the need to be looking beyond just collaborating information that collaborates management decision, you know, the need to have adequate procedures in place to gather outside information that informs the audit. Those are issues that, for which I can see the firm, you know, the culture that the firm sets, the expectations that they set, the guidance that they provide is going to drive partner conduct, and holding people accountable up the chain for the way they guide partner conduct, I think, will be helpful if we're going to have a chance of having, you know, the kind of audits that really hold the line and enforce the standards within a vaguer, less enforceable rule construct.